you invest in something you shouldn't have invested, lose one time your money. If you do not invest in something that you should have invested, you may be losing 100 times or 1,000 times the money that you could have made.
Oren Zeev, the billionaire solo venture capitalist behind Zeev Ventures, a one-man operation that has outperformed the biggest firms in Silicon Valley. What is that skill set you developed to best serve founders?
The most important thing is hiring. The success of the company is going to be predicated on the strength of the team that you build.
Why did you ultimately decide to do a one-man VC?
It saves me so much time that I don't need to manage anyone. Most of the deals that I do, I take 24 hours.
He's backed unicorns like House, Chegg, and Audible, and co-founded Tipalti, a financial technology company last valued at more than $8 billion. If you had to speak with your 30-year-old self and condense the wisdom you've learned over the last 3 decades into 3 pieces of advice for yourself, what would you want to tell yourself?
First, very, very, very clear, the customers are the founders, not the LPs. Go out of your way to be founder-friendly. Far more important to be supportive of the founder than to be right.
What do you think of Ilya from OpenAI raising at $30 billion valuation? Is this genius or is this insanity? Oren, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris, and thanks for having me.
I am fascinated with Israeli founders and companies and how they operate, and I think the world can learn a lot from how Israel conducts itself. And I think, I don't know the exact stat, but I know Israel has more billion-dollar companies per capita than any other country in the world. I want to pull back the curtain there. Like, you're highly qualified to speak on this. What do Israeli founders and companies do differently? How do they operate differently that creates such asymmetric results?
You know, Israel also has by far the largest number of engineers per capita. In other countries, you have, if you're good, you're a good student, you have many options, right? Whereas in Israel, tech is really the engine that drives the economy. Okay, of course, it can also be a doctor, a lawyer, but not much. You know, you're not going to go into. Let's put it this way: there's less of an opportunity, in industrial or in consumer goods or whatever. So first of all, there are way more engineers per capita, and I really think of Israel as an extension of the Silicon Valley. I think that, but whereas the Silicon Valley is a tiny percentage of the entire country, the Tel Aviv area is a much much bigger percentage of Israel. So I think, first of all, I don't know that Israelis do something very different from Silicon Valley founders. I just think that just so much of the country is about that. Also, everyone goes through the army, and many, many of the founders are either veterans of the top technology companies where they get great, first of all, there are filtered to get there. It's like some of these units are harder to get into than MIT or Stanford. And then they get at a very young age, responsibility to run with very, very exciting and innovative and secretive projects. And the other source of great entrepreneurs are just elite units, be it pilots or special ops or whatever. They don't maybe get the technical part or much less so, but they get other experience that maybe makes them more willing to take risks and be more resilient and all that. Probably this is the essence of it. I think there's, just like here in the US, there are really good universities. I myself went to the Technion, which is we like to think of ourselves as the equivalent of MIT, but there are other very good universities. And I think the last thing I would say, maybe where I do see Israeli founders, I'll say 2 more things. One is because there's no local market to speak of, then from day one, every company thinks of the global market and specifically the US as their market. So that's another reason why I see it as an extension of the Silicon Valley. Whereas if you go to France or in Italy, there's much greater chance that they would be tempted to go after the local market first. And by the time we're done with that, it's probably too late to win in the US. And the last thing I would say is that this, maybe the culture, very, very encouraging of entrepreneurship. And also, if I compare it to the Silicon Valley, I would say that people tend to be more loyal to the company. They feel more commitment. So even when things go a little bit tough, they don't all of a sudden disappear and go to the next shiny objects. So there's an advantage with that.
One thing I noticed when I spent a summer in Israel a few years ago, there's the term chutzpah, right? Like just this brazen, extreme confidence. And it was pretty shocking to see like just how confident people were in themselves on an average basis. And if you contrast that to Sweden, for instance, where culturally people are like conditioned not to self-advocate and to keep their heads down, to be humble, like Israelis seem to take a lot of pride and self-assuredness. Like, is this something that parents cultivate in their kids, or how is that socialized in Israel?
I think it's just always been part of the culture, even before tech. And by the way, it has its negative side as well.
It's true.
And the other part of chutzpah is, by the way, is to really be willing, if not to break the rules, really, really go very close to it, like bend the rules and, be close to the edge, as opposed to be very, very confined in the way things are supposed to be done. I think the opposite culture to Israeli culture is Japanese, probably, where everyone very much in line, do not challenge the authority, whereas Israeli culture, everyone feels confident to challenge anyone, pretty much. The Israeli army, in many ways, may be the least disciplined in the world because, you have regular soldiers who would, not have an issue question their commander. And again, these things have good side and bad side. The bending the rule, you probably saw that Israelis are really bad at waiting in line, in orderly fashion. People try to cut here from there. And it's or in traffic, it's a negative, in traffic, like every culture, things have. But as it happens, these things are actually probably good for entrepreneurship because when you start a new company, you don't want to accept the way you don't want founders will just accept the way the industry works because that's not where the innovation comes from. It's you want to founders who look at things, hey, I don't care that everyone is does it this way, or it's acceptable to do the one way and not the other way. And every now and then, people will maybe cross the line, which is not good, So that's why I'm saying there's good and bad. But generally speaking, yeah, I think the Israeli culture is very conducive to success in entrepreneurship.
Yeah, because you pointed out with Japan, like I think it comes down to what extent does society promote failure as a means to progress, right? To what extent does society promote risk taking? In Japan, if you fail in a company, they're the only country I know of with a specific word for like suicide by work or something. Or if they fail, like they failed their family, and like instead of just pivot and start a new idea, they're like, no, I am a failure, and it becomes an identity. Where in Israel, it's like, and it might come down to the particular predicament that Israel's in, being surrounded by so many enemies, where like you had to fail forward and innovate and build the best technology in the world to survive. And so you didn't have the luxury of having imposter syndrome, right? You're like, no, we have to fail and iterate at every level in this in the social hierarchy to then exist and thrive. I was like really interested in this one case study, the Yom Kippur War, which I think is like
I know.
probably.
I happen to be obsessed with it for some reason.
Well, then I'm glad we're
I
talking
was
about
very
this, because this really hit me, because there's such a defining case study in decentralized decision making, bottoms up decision making, and I think how businesses in the world should run. But Golda Meir, who was the prime minister, even after the war was won, and again, it was won by more junior soldiers that were empowered to make real time decisions. But even after the war was successful, a lot of the leadership of Israel was fired, right? Golda Meir, the prime minister, because the war should have been prevented, right? And it's like, well, why didn't you do your initial job? And so even in the face of victory, they're still having the audacity to say, where did we go wrong? And let's hold people accountable. And let's not just ride on the coattails of this victory, but like we have to always be getting better and assessing things from a pure sense of truth and meritocracy. Where in America, I feel like Golda probably would have got a gold medal. But like, why is this radical meritocracy not like the standard operating procedure for every business?
In many ways, it should. And in many ways, I think the Silicon Valley also works the same way. So I just think that I do think that this, and with all due respect to Israel, the Silicon Valley is still way bigger in terms of, being able to produce the, leading tech companies, et cetera. Israel is kind of a mix between Silicon Valley, New York, this aggression in the culture, and maybe Miami too, this beach culture. And, so maybe it's like, like a combination, a mix of the three in a way.
I always said Tel Aviv is like Miami and New York had a baby, or Silicon Valley could throw that too.
Exactly. Yeah. So I would add to that Silicon Valley for the tech piece. And there you have it: Miami, New York, and Silicon Valley on a very, very, very small piece of land.
Do you
very condensed?
Because I'm really interested to learn more about the inner operatings of Israel. And if you look at probably one of the best case studies would be the 8200 unit, right? You've got the founders of Wiz, Waze, Wix, some of the best companies coming out of 8200. I have a high level understanding of it, but for those who don't know, it's Israel's most elite military intelligence and cyber unit. Can you share, basically, because I know you have a lot of friends who've been in the unit, like, what does 8200 do differently that they're able to create such transformational technology and companies out of that unit? What do they do?
8200, my understanding is that it is the technology unit of so it's not just the elite, you know. So there are many less than elite people also at 8200, but there's also a lot of, you know, specific units within 8200, under 8200, which are very selective. As I said, I think within those units, first of all, the selection process, basically they test everyone. And remember, everyone has to go to the army when they turn 18. So first of all, they have the cream of the crop, okay, to begin with. And then, you know, people are very young. They don't have families. You know, they are 24/7. You know, it's 24/7. It's they also understand the importance of the mission. So it's just, my understanding is they're just extremely mission driven. And also, this is an opportunity also to build your network. And so then when companies start, if they have access to these pockets, again, it's not all of 8200. Someone may be just doing a mediocre job at 8200, and because they weren't they didn't have the medical profile to go to a combat unit, and you know, there's nothing special about them. But they're also part. So I don't want to, you know, it's not that anyone comes from 8200 is a genius, but there are pockets of excellence there, and within those pockets, they're very well defined, and you know, and people know, and then they bring them. You know, it's a friend brings a friend to the company, you know, after. So you have some companies that are real built on this talent, and you have the camaraderie, and you have the commitment to the mission, and the resilience, and you know, you got to deliver no matter what, which was a slogan at the peak of the war in Gaza, when some companies had a big percentage of their employees called up to the reserve. The slogan that everyone went with was that Israeli tech delivers no matter what, because no matter what happens in Gaza, it shouldn't be the problem of the customer of the startup, right? And so it doesn't matter what happened. You know, we have to, and this was my message to my companies, but they didn't need my message, all the CEOs, but they didn't need me for that message. They understood very well themselves, and they drove it, is that everything that's going on is not an excuse. We have to continue to deliver as if nothing has happened, because our competitors in the marketplace, you know, are our competitors. They're not gonna give us a break because we have other issues, and the customers should give us a break, you know, because of the problems that we have. It's pretty amazing to what extent Israeli tech showed its resilience in this war, because at the end of the day, I will tell you, I have a bunch of, most of my companies have significant operations in Israel. There's not a single one that I believe is going to be meaningfully impacted by the war. So the ones that are not succeeding because of the war. There's not one that I or the CEO would use the war as an excuse why we're not successful, which is, again, shows a lot about resilience. You know, you're not looking for excuses. When shit happens, you're not looking for excuses. You're looking to overcome these excuses. So, yeah, so I think back to 8200, I think the main thing is just you put the smartest people together at a very young age. And it's not different in a way than if you look at graduates maybe of top elite universities, you know, in the US, you know, and then you say, wow, what the percentage of these people have done really, really well? What percentage of successful companies they have Stanford or, you know, graduates do it pursuing them? So it's similar. Just, you know, when you put the best talent together, especially when they're young and they have no life other than that, good things happen.
It seems to speak to just the power of proximity. Like if you want to do great things, like the precursor to that is getting around the smartest people in the world at that thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Oren, I want to dig deeper into your investing career because you have done some pretty impressive stuff. I know from a returns perspective, you hang with the best in the world and even outperform a lot of them. But you're a one-man show. Why did you ultimately decide to do a one-man VC instead of link up with partners?
You know, my first 12 years in VC, I was in a large partnership. That's it. I don't need to say anything beyond that to explain why I deliberately chose.
You're like, I don't want anyone slowing me down. I want to do it my way.
Yeah, no, but it's exactly that. Look, I think that there is this myth that I really don't think it's a team sport. I think it's even the partnerships, most of them operate as an individual sports. And the fact that you have other people most around you, most of the time hurts more than helps. And part of the reason for that, by the way, is because it's such an asymmetric business in the sense that the cost of a mistake of omission is so much greater than a mistake of commission. So if you invest in something you shouldn't have invested, okay, you lose one time your money. If you do not invest in something that you should have invested, you may be losing 100 times or 1,000 times the money that you could have made.
Okay? The opportunity.
And having other partners who slow you down, they can help you. They can help you avoid mistakes of commission. But they will never, ever drive you to make investments that otherwise you would not have made. So they will never prevent mistakes of omission. And in fact, they will probably contribute to mistakes of omission because either they'll just, you know, just vote it down. By the way, the other thing is everyone agrees that you want to be contrarian in VC. How contrarian can it be if you convince 6 members of the investment committee? So almost by definition, the fact that you have an investment committee, you know, it drives you to be, you know, more go with, you know, the conventional wisdom and go with the herd and not do the things that are a little bit contrarian. Mm-hmm. And then I would say, even if I had very great, very smart partners, and even if 10 times they prevented me from doing a stupid investment, but one time, you know, they prevented me from making a great investment that was 100x or 200x, it wasn't worth it, the whole thing.
Was there a particular story at your prior firm where that happened? Where
missed out? There are many stories, you know. One of them, look, I was an investor. One of my first home run was Audible. And it was, I invested, I had, you know, 40% of the company. It was a great home run. We took it public. And then it hit hard times. And we were still, at that point, we sold some, but we were still maybe 20% owners. And I convinced the CEO to take it private, And the price was so cheap. I could have done it for $300 million. And the company was already like at close to $100 million ARR. And, you know, I couldn't get my partners, you know. And today this company is effectively totally controlling the audiobook market. It became a huge market. They're selling many billions of that. Now it's part of Amazon because after we didn't take it private, we decided, okay, they still decided, okay, he doesn't want to be public. If you're not going to take me private, I'm going to sell it. He sold it to Amazon. And by the way, Amazon left it to its own, pretty much let it run independently to this day. So that's one example. Even Facebook, at the time of the round that was done at 500 pre-money, not Mark. I never met Mark. I never talked to him even, but one of the top people there talked to me about it. Before I even scheduled the meeting, I brought it to the partnership. To me, it was a no-brainer. It was pre-revenue, but it was a no-brainer. But go and sell to a very conservative partnership the idea that you'd invested $500 million without a board seat for only 3 or 4% of the company, a pre-revenue company. It was the way. I didn't, honestly, I didn't even push it because it was so clear to me that there's no way I could prove it. So, and so, yeah, of course, it's just not worth it to me. And the fact that I'm by myself, by the way, saves me so much time because it's not just other partners. I don't have any employees. I don't have an assistant, etc. You know, it saves me so much time that I don't need to manage anyone. I don't like to manage other people. I don't even like to manage myself, let alone other people. So yeah, I just, and you know, and the fact is I can be so much more on the side of the founders. I don't need to explain myself to anyone. I can be super responsive because I don't have anything else other than respond to the partners because I don't have anyone, again, any organization to manage. I don't have any decisions other than investment decisions. You know, there's no decision about when I was in my previous partnership, you know, the calendar was just full of all sorts of routine meetings and this partnership meeting and this group meeting and this meeting and this whatever all the time and write reports and appraisals and career management of the people that you're managing and all the things that you do just because you're expected to do them even though you don't think you should do them but you're expected to. You cannot bring it to the IC and say, oh, I didn't bother to do this or that. No, you're set to do very thorough diligence, you know, even if you think it's just a waste of time. And by the way, time is a huge competitive advantage. If you can move way faster than anyone else, which I can, that in itself is a huge competitive advantage.
Right, you don't want to wait for approval on a term sheet. If you have instinct on the deal, get it done.
Most of the deals that I do, I take 24 hours.
24 hours on deals. Okay, wait, so if
most
you're-
Most of my deals really were over 24 hours, you know, because, you know, because I say if it's not obvious enough to me, I'd rather not do it. If I need to do like 3 weeks of research in order to get enough conviction, you know, it's just not worth it. And it's just not obvious enough. So
yeah, well, that's interesting though. So 24 hours, you said, because you have to get to a point of conviction. So how much of this is like thesis and framework driven versus pure intuition?
Zero thesis because I'm not thesis driven. I'm not, I don't have a view of how the world should look like. And based on that, try to invest. I trust the instincts of the founders better than I trust mine. So ideally for me is to meet a company on something that I would never even thought about, but realize that this team has a unique vantage point or viewpoint or some edge. And it's not obvious. I'll give you an example. I have one of my companies is called Exodigo. And this ties actually to the question about Israel. So it's called Exodigo, and the company was started in 2021. So I call it the seed. And the idea was that they would build a technology that would enable them to scan an area and generate a map of the underground. And the reason why this is such a huge opportunity, the use case that they chose was construction, because every construction project, they need to know what's underground. And today, they still use very, very low-tech methods like drilling samples, which obviously misses things and time-consuming and expensive and all that. So the idea of scanning an area and generating the... is so esoteric. Like, you know, no VC would have it as one of the theses that they're pursuing. Right? Now, why did this team have this idea? Because this is the team who built a similar system for the IDF for the tunnels of the Hamas and the Hezbollah. Okay, so obviously it's a different problem, but it's close enough that conceptually it's similar. So of course they, you know, redeveloped everything and repurposed, and it's not exactly the same problem, but the concept is the same. I mean, so they had a high level of confidence that they could solve it because they've done something similar before for the Israeli army, for the tunnels. Now, what other team would have that kind of experience? What other army has this issue of tunnels to deal with, you know? So that's an example of something that there's no way I could have come up with this thesis and then look for a company that does that. No, but I was lucky. So I really believe in serendipity. I believe that several times a year I will meet a great team with a great idea. And then my job is to identify it, you know, recognize it and move fast and lock it. That's it.
So what I'm pulling from that, there's someone who has a unique insight and a unique background that makes them credible to have that insight. And then the team itself has a unique competitive edge on executing against that problem. And if the idea is directionally interesting, they have relevant backgrounds that tell you that they have a high probability of succeeding, and the team actually has the skill sets required to execute, that's sufficient for you.
Yeah. And by the way, and even that, it's not always ideal. I'll give, for example, Navan, I'd known the founders before, and I've even invested in their previous company. So I thought the world of them, and on the technology and on the product vision and all that, and that. And their insight was that corporate travel sucks. Now that is not such a unique insight, okay? Mm-hmm. And they had the relevant experience because they were executives, they were using business travel. So they just were frustrated with the experience that they experienced. Now they're not the only people in the world who had the same unique this unique experience, because it's not. But I felt that, number one, they do understand the problem because they suffered from themselves, and number two, between the two of them, they bring world-class capabilities in product and technology, and also we had prior relationship, so I knew that I had an angle, and that they wanted me to back them because they had other options as well. They were not the only team in the world that could have built it, but they focused on the problem at the right time. And it wasn't obvious, by the way. In 2015, which is when we started the company, I can guarantee you that no VC had corporate travel as one of their 10 of things to pursue, okay? Because everyone felt that corporate travel was done, this is like a 50. Everyone felt in 2015 that corporate travel was already solved by the likes of Amex or Concur, but the fact that it sucked, would not make it. It wouldn't make the cut to be one of the things that NVC pursues. So that's another example.
Well, that's an interesting point you made, because there's two paths I see in venture to that determine success. One is just being able to source and land the right deals, but then there's founders like Navan and others where they're kind of home run founders, and it's just, can you get allocation? Can you get access? Can they, can you win the deals, right? The competing for the deals, people want you on their boards. Like, you're a very hot commodity in the venture space. What is your edge that you bring to founders? How did you develop yourself to be somebody that founders want on their cap table?
Well, first, it took many years. I've been doing it for 30 years now. And I can tell that looking back, I did not have this advantage in the first 10, 12, 13, maybe 15 years. Okay. Mm. So it takes a long time to develop this reputation.
Yeah.
And I think it's a combination of, number one, people want to be associated with success. So the fact that, the more successes you have, the better position you have. When I did Audible, which was my first home run, I had no advantage in reputation. I had no way to win. The only reason I won is because nobody competed, because it was 2003 and, everyone was shell-shocked. And so if they had any alternative, I would have lost. I'm convinced of that. Luckily, they didn't have any alternative at that point in time. And I moved fast, to my credit. But the bigger thing, I think, is that I adopted an extreme founder-friendly approach that many people say. Some people also deliver on it. To me, it's part of the brand. To me, I would go to the extreme. I would rather lose a company and have the founders say good things about me than the other way around. Mm. And because I focus very much on the Israeli, not exclusively, but
about 80%.
I have a big focus on the Israeli ecosystem. It's a very intimate ecosystem. Everyone knows everyone. So they're not relying on my PR or my website or the media. They're relying on their best friends who tell them, hey, and by the way, most of my deals are sourced by other founders in my portfolio.
Because you've helped them so much that they're a raving fan of you, and they're like, you'd really benefit from knowing this guy.
They rave about me in a way they don't rave about someone else. And it's not because necessarily I know the future. It's not because I have this amazing, I have my own personal network, but obviously, it's not because I have, six offices worldwide, or because I have a special team for talent and a special team for I don't know, whatever the big platforms have. No, it's just the personal connection, and you know they can trust me. They know I'm always gonna support them, and they know I'll do everything also to help them succeed. You know, within my power. And
yeah, what is that skill? What is that skill set you developed to best serve founders? Is it helping with talent? Is it helping with commercial, like customers? Is it helping with business strategy or technology? Like, where do you really come in and add the most value?
Yeah, it's definitely not giving them advice on technology or even business strategy, other than very generic. There's nothing unique there. But, having done it for 30 years and having done it successfully, I have a meaningful network, and I'm just using it in favor of the, whether it's early customers for B2B, for B2B companies, mm-hmm. whether it's, if they have a technical problem, maybe I can connect them with someone who can help them. Mm-hmm. But the most important thing is hiring, because mm-hmm. the most important thing is when you are, the success of the company is going to be, assuming you have a good idea, the success is going to be predicated on the strength of the team that you built and the suitability of the team. And the best people that you have, that you want to get, always have alternatives. So you want to win them over, and you also want to back channel them so that you know they're the best people.
Yes.
And I can really deliver on all these things. Now, I think that there are others, especially people who've been doing it for a long time, who can deliver also, but usually they're too busy because they have a firm to run. Like my contemporary, my peers, typically today, they run big shops, and yeah. 95% of their time is deciding, which tiles to have in the office. I don't know, and how you promote this, and all things that I don't care about. And I just have a lot of free time to use in favor of the companies, and I prioritize it as well. So. So I think it's less that I'm such a special person that I can do things that others can't. It's more that I have the time and the motivation and the focus to do it. And because it's an intimate group, the world is really I'm not limited to Israeli founders, but even the ones who are not Israeli, typically there was some, it almost always I had some special right to win, or some relationship, some very close relationship, or it could be someone who was close to me before I made the investment, for example.
Right. Yeah, I think building a reputation in a particular territory is a huge benefit. Because when I went to Israel, I asked a bunch of my founders, who are the people I have to meet there? And I met with a bunch of great VCs and founders, but a couple of founders were like, cold email this guy named Oren Zeev, if you can. He might be there. He's hard to get in touch with. He's a freaking legend. You should try to meet him if possible. I didn't get a reply back then, but we connected a year or so later. Yeah. But your reputation in Israel just was massive. Like, everyone knew you, and you're kind of enigmatic there to some extent, which is funny.
And I don't even need to go there physically because they find me and everything can be done over Zoom and,
Well, that's the cool part, I think, that's inspiring for people to take away from this, is if you focus on mastering your craft for decades, eventually you build a brand, which is, for me, just reputation at scale. Of being someone who's extremely valuable, and then everything comes to you inbound.
No, I think it's the secret of success of all the top VCs. At the end of the day, nobody has monopoly over the future, of knowing what's gonna be in the future, and it's really hard to consistently be smarter than others about the future. But what you can be consistently better than others is just to be more attractive to founders. At the end of the day, it could be based on some edge that you have, or just a general legendary brands like, Sequoia or Andreessen. That's why this is an industry that really favors the leaders. We as venture capitalists look for industries that do not favor the incumbents. Because then it's easier to, disrupt with a new company. But VC industry does favor the incumbents. And of course, it's not automatic, and you can always, and every now and then there's someone new manages to get into the top bracket. But in general, it's not a level playing field. Unlike public investing. Public investing, every year, everyone starts from the same point, and there's little correlation between people who were successful last year and people who will be successful this year. Mm-hmm. Everyone has the same access to information in general, up to a point. I'm not talking about algo trading. I'm talking about, let's say, people who invest based on fundamentals. And everyone has the same access. Anyone, I can buy Google, you can buy Google, you know, just as easily. You know, it's not the case in venture. Most of the deals, other people would have done it as well if they had the opportunity. But I got to win. I got to see them. And many times, it wasn't even competitive. Nobody else got even to see it because the founders first want to see if they can get it for me. And then, if not, then would have gone to others. So I think, and what's true for me is also true for others. Mm-hmm. So in venture, it's so important to be in the top tier for whatever you do.
Yes.
Because otherwise, you could still get lucky, but you'll have to rely on luck, just like I did with my first win.
Yes, yes. And then that's a great,
you know, point. In the beginning, the cards were stacked against me. You know, it takes time to, but then I wasn't, and the brand of my previous firm was not that strong. So it's not, I didn't win it because of the brand of the firm.
Right. You had,
won it because nobody else was going to deal with it.
What do you think? There's this emergence, I wouldn't say emergence, but it's even more hyper exaggerated now, of VCs investing as like talent as product, meaning like you're investing in the founding team pre-product, pre-revenue because of who they are. You're seeing Ilya from OpenAI raising at a 10 billion valuation, or no, 30 billion valuation. You're seeing $30 billion valuation he's raising at. Mira, the former CTO, at 10 billion valuation, pre-product, pre-revenue. Yeah. Is this genius or is this insanity?
First of all, it's not something I do. Certainly not. I do it, but on a much smaller scale. Okay, I would invest in people a few places where it would prove itself to work out. And there will be many more places what would prove itself not to work out. And overall, that's why I don't know that it's genius, but I don't know that it's necessarily insanity. I don't want to, you know, refer to these specific two cases, which, you know, I don't know. I haven't seen either. And I don't know either person. Well, I don't know either personally, but I don't know. Time will tell. I feel that I can find better opportunities than investing in something so unclear at 30 billion just because. But it could work out. Who knows? You know?
Yeah, they'd have to build a company the size of Google to really hit the return profile.
I know. I honestly, this maybe does. I know I said a minute ago, it's not genius, it's not insanity. Maybe this one tilts a little bit more over on, you know, towards the side of insanity on that spectrum.
They always call you crazy until you're right.
That's true too. That is true too. And but yeah, I mean, if I was offered, I was not. But if I was offered, I'm pretty sure that, and also I didn't see the pitch. Who knows? Maybe the pitch justifies it. But assuming that there's no surprises in the pitch, if I saw it, it's just not my deal. It's not one of the things that I do. I usually go very early. Usually I'm a very significant shareholder. I lead my deal. I mean, even co-lead is an exception for me. And I'm typically the largest early backer, and many times I'm the largest backer the whole, you know, even at the towards the end of the journey.
Because your framework isn't to go after and acquire 1,000 companies. It's, I'm gonna pick fewer companies, high conviction.
It's very targeted. It's very small. Yeah. And I'm also not a logo collector. I don't do the sprint prey. I'm not a logo collector. Even if I happened to have a small investment in a company that became very big, I would be embarrassed to talk about myself as a legitimate investor, because, you know, it's not to me, if you own one or two, okay, you didn't really play a meaningful role if you didn't, if you weren't very close to the company. On, you know, again, at the end of the day, it's the founders who made the company, not the investors. But anyways, I would even be embarrassed to talk about something if I was just a passive, like random insignificant investor.
You've been at this game for 30 years now. I'm curious if you had to speak with your 30-year-old self and condense the wisdom you've learned over the last three decades into three pieces of advice for yourself, what would you want to tell yourself?
The first, very, very, very clear, is the customers are the founders, not the LPs, and go out of your way to an extreme degree to be founder-friendly. From that perspective, it's far more important to be supportive of the founder than to be right. Even if you're right and the founder is wrong, okay, you can tell them, try to convince them, but at the end of the day, support them. And That, and by the way, that was not obvious because in my old firm, that was definitely not what I picked up there. And if anything, I picked up to do the opposite of what they were doing. Okay. So, and so my first 12 years, I cannot say that I was, even if I wanted to be supportive of the founders, I was in a certain,
You're constrained.
certain framework and I couldn't. Yeah. So that to me is so important. The second thing I would say, it's all about developing a competitive advantage in the right to win and in the access, because it was because of what I said before. You cannot realistically expect to consistently be smarter than others about the future. You want to be able to win the ones that you really want to invest in. By the way, we did not prepare for this at all. You didn't tell me what you're gonna ask me,
Not
so
at
that's
all. I'm
why I
putting
didn't
you right
prepare
on
the question.
the
Then yeah, I didn't think of, so I may have better three, but this is just the three that came to me right now. The third one is that, and again, it's related, find your strengths and really double down on your strengths as opposed to try to so don't have FOMO. So for example, not have FOMO for not seeing things. I'm not trying to see everything. I'm trying to see three or four or five new deals that I would want to do a year. That's it. I don't care that I didn't see this or that. So I don't measure myself by the number of deals that I see. I actually don't see many relative to others because many VCs, including my own VCs, we judge ourselves. We always sell 70%, we sell 80%, we sell
Yeah,
60% of the
so,
deals we
like some
cut.
Harvard admission thing.
Don't care at all about it. And related to that, again, find the edge. Or the other example of playing on your strengths. I don't care about thought leadership, for example. So it's not like, oh, this person is getting this, keeps publishing all this great content, and because of that, they're getting recognition. No, that's their thing. Or, oh, I need to have a team so that we can help in a more structured way. Companies getting in front of I don't know buyers or getting whatever it is or have get someone as a talent acquisition partner to help the companies. Yeah, this could be relevant ideas. I'm not saying it's not, but I don't feel compelled or moved to do anything different. I have my playbook and I just double down on the playbook and because of that I can be so focused on my playbook and not copy from others, which could very well be great playbooks for them. It's not that I'm being dismissive of people who do have talent acquisition teams, I think. But basically just play your strength and not try to be like others. Just it's okay to be different. In fact, it's good to be different.
That's damn good advice. I think VC is built on being contrarian. Like, find your formula.
Yeah, but then everyone behaves the same.
But then
It's like
everyone else
airlines,
becomes the same and they say they're contrarian.
Airlines is the worst. There's no way you can tell if you don't look at the logo. There's no way you can tell if you're on a Delta, an American, or a United flight, right? There's zero difference.
That's so interesting. You make such great points there. And even thinking back for myself, I was like, all right, how do I get into venture? Because I didn't come from one of these top venture funds and underwriting deals. And I'm actually not a great math guy. I can't look at financial projections and I don't know the markets. But I'm like, what I do know is people. And I've developed an eye for spotting talent.
The most important thing to
And then, we built a recruiting function to build startups, but we built a really nice niche in the engineering side of things, right? Building founding engineering teams. And that got us access to cap tables like ClickUp. We just did some deals with Elad Gil. The founders of Rubrik and Glean, like we're getting on some insane cap tables because they're like, hey, you have a very differentiated ability here, and this happens to be extremely valuable to us at the early stage, and it's valuable enough to where we want you on the cap table. And so anyone can kind of figure out their thing.
By the way, that's also the advantage of size, that you don't have to win the deal. It's okay just to con you don't need to convince them that they should take you over everyone else. All you need to convince them is that it's worth making an allocation for you because you're gonna bring something unique to the table,
Yes.
right?
Yes.
And absolutely, that would be if anyone came to me as a relatively, how do I get an edge? How do I win against Sequoia? I would say you don't need to win against Sequoia because that would be, a stretch. What you really need to do is just be unique enough, differentiate enough that the founders would wanna, even if they got the money from Sequoia, they would wanna also allocate something for you to get whatever unique aspect you bring to them.
100%. And I think I'm following in your footsteps here, because I've built enough of a reputation. I've had a number of unicorns that I've seeded with small six-figure allocations. And then I don't want to compete with Sequoia. I want them to see me as a value-added partner, yeah, where I take enough of the cap table where it's interesting for me, but it's not competitive to them. And then after that track record builds over time, then eventually I have the opportunity to go out and go head-to-head with them. But it takes time, decades, to build that.
Exactly. At some point, you might feel comfortable to go. But it takes so long, you know, before you really, for everyone, it takes so long. You know, it took them many years to become Sequoia also. You
absolutely.
Know, they didn't start as,
yeah, and then the young guns come in and they have a 30-year-old brand behind them, 40-year-old brand behind them, so they can accelerate.
Yeah, good for them. Good for them. And they probably have to be brilliant to be hired by them.
Yep.
And then it's not easy, by the way. No. I wouldn't trade places with them. Like internally, I'm sure it's not easy.
Oren, you have an insane network. I'm just curious, who is the smartest person you ever met? And what did you learn from them?
Oh, I think I got a lot of inspiration. Despite everything that I said about my old firm or implied about my old firm, I think the founder of that firm, his name is Sir Ronald Cohen. He's just a very inspiring person. And certainly earlier in my career, it was someone to look up to, or in a certain situation, how would Ronald carry himself in this situation? What would he say, you know, as a guide for me? So maybe that's the person that popped in my
I'm
head.
I'm sure there's a lot of them. What is one tactical thing that he taught you, or like something that he instilled in you that you attribute some of your success to?
You know, I don't think it's, because I didn't work very closely with him. You know,
it was more just like observing him as an inspirational figure.
It's more like someone who looks inspiring, and you know, and the leader, and you know, someone who doesn't hesitate to come up with, you know, innovative ideas. But it was less something like very, you know, I don't even know to what extent it was a great deal guy, you know, or but just someone who, to this day, by the way, he is now in the impact world, etc. But he's still very inspiring, the things that he does. Although he's not young, but he still does great things, and I'm still in touch with him. But and he's still very inspiring. You know, in Elad Gil, we just mentioned, I think he's super smart. I just cannot point to something specific that I learned from him, but I do think he's very smart. I mean, there are many, many smart people in this business. There's no
Shortage. I'm curious, like on like
Ben Horowitz, who is on the board with me at Navan, you know, often has great insights. I think he's a superb board member, you know, so yeah.
What were, if you can remember any of them, like I find, you know, we're always learning, we're always iterating.
And Peter Thiel Peter Thiel is another one that I think is super smart. Every time we sat down and we like compared notes, you know, we're like on the same wavelength in terms of not chasing where, you know, where everyone is chasing, but actually look for companies that are doing something more special. And and the fact that you actually don't want in the beginning necessarily that it's a hot market. It's the opposite. You want something that is kind of out, you know, that maybe other people think it's limited, and you know, you have time to really build your leadership, and to what extent leadership is important.
Yep.
I didn't know that I specifically learned from him, but I share a lot of the ideas that he shared with the world in his book, Zero to One.
It's a great book. Because when I look back at somebody, there's usually like a handful of shaping events or people in someone's life. We meet thousands of people, we read a bunch of books and blogs, but whether it was like an event you went to, or a coach you worked with, a particular job experience, maybe it was a book, but usually there's a few things that really just shape us as individuals. Was there any person or idea that really shaped you?
You know, maybe a book, you know, it's like, this goes back 30 years ago, 25 years ago, but I think that, and there are classics, and there are, like, maybe since then people have written things that are more relevant, but for me, they were very differently shaped my thinking about venture. One was Crossing the Chasm, which must be a 40-year-old book, but and the other one was Innovator's Dilemma. And I think there's still, you know, with everything that went in venture, And every 10 years, people, oh, now it's a new world, now it's all different. You know, those fundamentals ideas are still valid, as yeah, are still
It's
definitely valid and are
timeless.
still great frameworks still.
Okay, so those are two books everyone
There
who
are
wants to
perennial
get in.
sources of wisdom. Yeah.
I love it. I am really curious about this, Oren. What would you say was your primary motivational fuel early in your career? And I'm curious if it's the same thing still driving you today or if that's evolved.
Wow, you ask deep questions. I would say I did want to succeed, so just success. And I was definitely not athletic enough to succeed in sports. I don't think I was smart enough to succeed in theoretical physics or because I started as an engineer, not physics, but I started as electrical engineer. And originally my thinking was that I would go into academia and you know, and then the, and then the, and there in academia, the success is the number of papers that get published and you know in which journals they get published and what kind of other honors you get. And my driver was success. It wasn't money, you know. I was never driven by money, and still I'm not driven by money per se, but money is in this profession is a measure of success. So it's only meaningful in that it measure the success. So I was driven by success. I think that today I'm probably still driven by success, but maybe I'm a little bit more relaxed about it, you know. Maybe I'm a little bit wiser and older. The other driver that may not have been in the beginning, but now is a big driver, is the relationships with the founders as really someone who's really, you know, with them. And there's a huge overlap between my who I consider friends and the people that I backed, whether they were friends before I backed them or became friends afterwards. And the last thing I would say is just this huge privilege of being really part, and not the driver's seat, but the passenger seat, really being part of building companies that are reshaping the respective industries. These are the three. Just winning, still important to me. I wouldn't be enjoying it that much if I was losing. And then the relationship with the founders and being part of building something big, where I don't think I have the skills to build it myself, like to be a founder of a company operational. I never done it, so it's not. But I get at least at least I get the chance to be there with them and be their support system and help when possible, when I can, etc.
That was really, really well articulated. I keep thinking about a quote from Michael Ovitz, the founder of CAA. And he's like, I think he's a fascinating human. But ambition and insecurity make a powerful cocktail.
Yeah,
And
I think it's true for me too. Yeah, I think it's true for me too. I don't think I'm insecure today, but definitely because, but definitely when I started out, I was much more insecure for sure. No.
because you didn't have the success accolades to lean on, people didn't
Yeah.
take you
Yeah.
seriously, and you're like, you know what? I think I'm
Yeah.
great, but the
Yeah.
world doesn't see me as this yet. I'm gonna keep working until the world perceives me the way I
Yeah.
perceive myself.
Yeah. I also always looked much younger than I was, so it really bothered me when I was 30 and looked 20, and what I was that people didn't take me seriously, so
It's a powerful thing because I reflect on this a lot because I think it has such a tremendous impact on our success and on our fulfillment
yeah.
is being hyper aware of the energy you're creating from, right? Like, are you using anger and like, you have a chip on your shoulder, I got to prove something to the
Yeah.
world versus like you're creating as an
Yeah.
artist from love because you're pursuing this passion you're obsessed with. And
Yeah.
I've noticed that with myself. I started out wanting financial security and just wanting to be somebody. I was tired of not being anyone in the
Yeah.
world, right? And then
Yeah.
after I created more financial security and more success relative to my own career, I'm like, you know what? I don't want to be operating from this place of lack and needing to prove myself all the time. I want to be an artist. I want to create a masterpiece of a company. I want to focus on serving versus on serving my own ego and trying to prop myself up and be important. And I found I'm actually more successful now, and I'm actually a lot happier without using that kind of fuck you energy on a day-to-day basis that I think earlier on.
Oh yeah. No, I think I'm much better now that my insecurity is more in check, and I don't feel I feel less competitive with other investors. For example, I never felt competitive with founders, which is Which some investors do. Some
they
investors
do. They do.
get,
Yeah.
you know, who is, yeah. So at least I don't, I never had this problem, but I feel less competitive with other investors. So I think early on it was a driver for sure.
If you had to think back, and obviously you've been massively, massively successful financially in the business sector, but when you look at like what it really takes to live a world-class life, a great holistic life, what comes to mind for you?
I think the most important thing is, first of all, your life partner, your spouse. I think that in that department I've been very lucky. And your immediate family, you know, I think you know, your children and the their well-being and their relationship. I think that is probably the most important thing. Beyond that, you know, financially, you just need to be comfortable. I don't think that. And I'm, by the way, my lifestyle is middle class plus. You know,
so you don't live the billionaire lifestyle.
Not at all, not even close. You know, I don't, and I have no desire to own anything other than a 6-year-old car and, you know, and yeah, nice house here, a nice house in Israel, and that's it, you know, for our visits. So that's why it's not middle class, really. That's why I said plus, but, and I do fly business, but I don't fly private.
Really? That's crazy to hear. What do you do with all your money then?
Yeah. Nothing, honestly. First of all, most of it is not 99% of it is not liquid. But if I felt that I wanted to live differently, I would make sure it is, you know, it is more liquid, because you can always sell things that at some discount. You know, just a question.
Oh yeah, secondaries.
Yeah, yeah, but and you know, obviously give.
Yeah.
To philanthropy, but yeah, I don't have, again, I don't have any use for the money other than as a measure of success, and then.
It's more for the game.
It only creates more work, and now I need to decide where to give it, you know, so who to give it to, you know.
Dude, I love that answer. You remind me, I just had Jim McKelvey, the co-founder of Square, on, you know, and he made billions in Square, but he's still working, grinding every day in an office in New York City, building startups.
Well, that's what we have to do. There's no reason why I would stop, you know. I could stop. I could have stopped. Even, I could have stopped before I started, you know. I could have stopped. After the first 12 years, it was enough to live a very comfortable life. You know, I was financially independent. But, and by the way, I did take a year to figure out what I wanted to do. And I didn't think of work. I tried things, different things. I just, at the end of the day, am most drawn by this. I feel it's kind of like more of a closest to a life calling. And, you know, that this is what I, so I see myself continuing to do it forever. It's not like, oh, I only want to, it's not like I have like an objective. I want to get to X and then I will do Y. You know, if I want to do Y, I'll do it now. You know, and if I wanted to stop doing X, I'll stop doing X today. You know, but right now what I want to do is continue more of the same. And, you know, and I'm not getting tired of it yet. And I doubt that I would get tired from it. But
yeah.
But so far, I'm not close to getting tired.
That's amazing, man. It's cool to see someone who's found their life's work. Who's like, it's a never-ending journey. Death is the calling card. Until then, you're just playing the game. I have one more question for you. The preface to that is, have you seen the movie called Men in Black?
It's with Will Smith, right?
Yes, exactly. So,
but to be honest, I have such bad memory, Chris, that I might have seen it 20 years ago. I honestly do not remember if I have or not.
Cool. You don't have to know the context here, but in that movie, there's a pen called the Neuralizer. And this pen, if you're zapped with it, it erases your memory. So if you were about to get deneuralized and your memory was about to be wiped clean, but before you could write down one message to yourself that you could take into your next life, what would you write down?
Oh, wow. Deep. This is really deep. That to be successful in life, in all aspects of life, doesn't matter, relationship, business, etc., being true to yourself and to others, and you know, is a better way to go. It's not that, because I think when you're younger, it's hard to know, and you see all sorts of role models that are assholes and seem to be, or could seem to be, successful to young people, right? I know I hear, not that I follow, but I hear, for example, there's all sorts of really bad role models for kids on social networks. And, but you know, their kids, what do they know? So they see, So maybe, again, I didn't have time to think about it, so it's probably a lame answer. This myth that you need to be an asshole to be successful, or you need to fake things, or you need to be fake, or work on your image in order to be successful is a myth. Maybe you could be successful this way, but probably it has a big price, and you could also be very successful in your relationship, or probably more successful in your relationship, and because at the end of the day, people. So if I can define it in one word, and sorry for babbling, and until I got to something, but maybe authenticity. Just be authentic. We're not try to. And it's hard when you're young, because when you are young, it's hard to be authentic, because you don't have enough self-confidence that what you bring to the table is good enough. So you
Yeah.
are, so you're drawn to fake based on the kid who is more popular than you maybe, or so things like that. So maybe this is it. Just be authentic, and it's and it.
Be
And
you.
things will work out well.
No, it's really good advice and harder to live, but I think it is kind of the crux of living a great existence, right? It reminds me of Naval Ravikant's quote, escape competition through authenticity, right? You got to find the thing that
Yeah.
makes you unique and embrace it and own it and share
I
that
love
with
it.
the
I
world.
didn't remember this walk, and it's great. So authenticity is one. And the other thing is being truthful, because I think that when I really try and never ever to I really believe that I really never say something, never misrepresent, and never. But it wasn't always the case. I know it was always more. It's not that I was. But some even white lies, for example. When I grew up, the message was, oh, it's acceptable. White lies, for example. The someone calls the house, and your parent tells you to tell them I'm not home, or something like that.
Yeah.
Today, I would never say this to my kids, okay? This is, what do you mean? This is, and this was like, so to me, there's no difference between a white lie and not a white lie. I'm just gonna, and so makes life so much easier, because 99.9% of the lies are unnecessary. You could just say that, you could just say the truth, and things will be fine. And yet people feel embarrassed about the truth, so they make up some stupid excuse, etc. So I would never, I would never make up an untrue excuse why I didn't do this or that, or why I was late. If I messed up, I'll just say I messed up. What's gonna happen? So anyway, that's maybe the other thing I would say. Just be authentic, and truthful, and things will
In a world where we're so compelled to be a character, to get society to like us, that's so difficult, but it ultimately, that's how you maintain your integrity, you build reputation, and you, especially the reputation you have with yourself, by being honest.
Today it's easy for me, but yeah, of course, when I was younger, it was much harder,
Yeah.
to
I'm looking forward to getting there myself when I'm older, but it's still challenging. But it's an effort every day just to be more of yourself.
You have time to get to my age.
I got a couple
You have
years.
time.
This is amazing, man. Well, thank you. Yeah, I feel grateful to be able to talk to you. I always learn a lot from you, and I think you're just a super inspiring guy. So thank you for sharing some of your
Thank you.
insights and stories with the world.
Thank you. That was great. That was fun. More fun than I expected.